The OTB Podcast Network with Green Farm on the go. Snack smart with 100% natural protein-powered chicken bites.
Shane, the big story here that's getting completely overshadowed by your boys Monaghan is that unbelievable clash last night in the Champions League. Two beautiful styles of play in Bayern Munich and Paris Saint-Germain, just creating a cocktail of madness.
Oh, the definition of end-to-end. I mean, like, I think John Duggan tweeted last night saying it made him forget about lockdown for a short time. And I think a lot of people, kind of football fans, would have felt the same way last night. Watching this game was just so enjoyable, every moment of it. And five goals, probably. There could have been a lot more than five goals in that match. But and special mention to the referee as well. We gave the referee in the City-Dortmund game a bit of guff the other day for his bad decision on the Jude Bellingham incident. But Antonio Mateo Lahoz, the referee last night, let the game flow. This was great to see. It definitely helped. You know, any incidents that required some action, he came back and dealt with them. But let the game flow. He took no crap. Let the game just roll. And just what a game. I mean, after 78 minutes, an image popped up on screen to say that Bayern had 25 attempts on goal to PSG's 5. Yet PSG led. So it was just one of those matches. I was worried a bit before the game. You know, Lewandowski missing for Bayern, Verratti missing for PSG. So a couple of big names. And then you see the players coming out onto the pitch in the snow, and Neymar's not got his gloves on, and Mbappe's got his gloves on. So you're thinking, Mbappe's gone a bit soft here. He's not up for this. He doesn't like the cold weather. And then he does what he does. He was just extraordinary last night, Kylian Mbappe. And that was a test for Paris Saint-Germain. You know, I guess the heat has been on them since they lost the final last year, and people saying they need this Champions League win to, I guess, officially join the big boys club in Europe. Manchester City are probably in the same bracket. But to feel at home in Europe's elite, beating Bayern Munich 3-2 at the Allianz Arena is not a bad way to do it. And just one of the more enjoyable games of football I think we've watched in recent months.
So many different layers to it as well. I love the Marquinhos mic drop. Play 28 minutes, gets in 4 blocks, which is the highest amount of blocks made by any player in a single Champions League game this season. 28 minutes. He won 100% of his duels, 7 clearances, and of course, he scored a goal as well. Just like in terms of half an hour of a game played by any individual, it has to be up there as one of the most memorable. The snow will make it stick out as something. And the fact that I think PSG had 10 touches in Bayern Munich's box, and Bayern Munich had 69 touches in the Paris Saint-Germain box, which is just incredible. And I guess it comes down to Lewandowski. Like, no disrespect to Choupo-Moting, who could be maybe a top 10 striker in the world. But the problem is, Robert Lewandowski is maybe the best striker in the world. So that's always going to be a missing cog for them. Like, this machine that looked so well-oiled last year, you take one player out of it, you take the spearhead out of that team, and all of a sudden all their brilliant play can just result in something like that last night.
It did have the feeling of a screenplay at times. When you mentioned the Marquinhos stuff and even Choupo-Moting, his story, our own Ronan Mullen from Off the Ball, talking about this, his life almost being like a movie now. The fact that we remember him from Stoke City, and then of course he gets the move to Europe, and now look at him. He's just doing extraordinary things, and what a player. And like, Bayern didn't deal with corners well. They didn't deal with set pieces well. The long balls into the box. PSG clearly targeted that, but I guess the dramatic effect of it all was the camera work as well. They kept, any time Thomas Müller did something good, they cut to Jogi Löw up in the stands, the German manager, who hasn't been you know, having any plans for Thomas Müller at international level at the moment. It was kind of a two fingers up from Thomas Müller, his performance last night and his performances generally recently. Lovely ball in from Joshua Kimmich as well for his header. And then they kept cutting to Oliver Kahn in the stands. It had echoes of, you know, Barcelona 99 when Solskjaer scored the winner in the Champions League final. And it cut to, I think it was maybe Lothar Matthäus in the stands, who just looked absolutely shell-shook. And then you have Sami Kufur beating the ground and just reacting like that. And, with, you know, anytime PSG scored, they cut up to Oliver Kahn in the stands. Per Oliver Kahn, Bayern legend, a board member now with Bayern, and someone who's due to take over the CEO of Bayern from 2022. And he's just sitting there, head in hands, desolate and completely upset and distraught by this situation and the fact that his team have conceded 3 away goals in the Champions League quarterfinals. So it had all the feel of a screenplay, all the feel of just an absolutely cracking European tie. And a couple of people afterwards saying, oh, maybe this European Super League wouldn't be a bad idea after all. But then again, you know, Brian Kerr saying on TV last night, and rightly so, not every game is going to be like this in a potential European Super League. You're going to have some crap matches as well. But it was a really good advertisement for the Champions League. There's no doubt about it.
You need the knockout stages. Simple as that. If there's any place where, even if it's two legs, once you get to last 16 quarterfinals, it's just delivered year after year after year, the Champions League in recent years. We are continuing on this with Graham Hunter. Good morning to you, Graham.
How are you on?
Last night, a Renaissance painting of a game, Paris Saint-Germain against Bayern Munich.
You've thrown that at me because I've used that about a match once. That's a little dig, isn't it? It was playground football as well. I mean, I share your excitement, and I was absolutely glued to it. I had no interest really in watching Chelsea beat Porto. It's a match I've been looking forward to for a long time for several reasons. Number one, I think we're used to Champions League fights. You know I'm a devotee. I absolutely love the Champions League. And I'm sorry, I just came in the middle of the last conversation. Whoever in Ireland was talking about the new League of Europe or whatever, they're tosh. They shouldn't be touching the Champions League. The opinion that the group games aren't fun enough is absolute mince. It's repeated by sheep. The knockouts are generally fabulous. Anybody who's my age remembers the old European Cup and the way in which it was stalemate, catenaccio, draw away from home, turgid, the finals were fear-filled. And this has been, we've lived in an era of European football where we haven't just been entertained during the Champions League, particularly in knockout stages. It's changed the shape of football, it's changed the attacking intent of football. Teams for years now, planners, players, have treated away matches as if they were home matches. And again, anybody of my age remembers that's anathema to the way football was played. So last season's final, even though it was in strange circumstances, I thought it didn't show the best of either team. So a rematch now, to me, I'd skin in the game because to my sponsors and my podcast, I'd suggest that Mbappe would overtake Haaland for ultimate top scorer in the competition. I suggested that PSG would not Bayern out. I was laughed at. They're not through. Mbappe hasn't won the Pichichi yet. It isn't over, but boy, I enjoyed the first installment. And I did think it was playground football. I'm not entirely sure why, because there were times when Bayern kind of shook themselves off and stormed forward. And it looked as if PSG weren't going to get off the ropes. It ticked me off a little bit that having created two goals, Neymar didn't do what great players, even great feet, Peter Pan players like him, should do, which is to say, I'll show for the ball, I'll take the pressure away, I'll draw this game to the other end of the pitch. And he went missing for a little while, and that tipped me off. And Danilo having to be moved out of centre midfield, where I thought he was prepared to have his best ever game for PSG, it just left the game where it looked like Bayern weren't simply going to keep on generating the number of chances that they did. Although, you know, Kehler was very, very good, but was he producing mind-blowing saves? No. At any rate, at that stage, Bayern normally, particularly at home, crowd or not, will mash you, will just put you through the ringer. And ultimately, they didn't. I'm a huge Mbappe fan. I'm not addicted to predicting transfers anymore. That was once the case. But I am interested to see, if he chooses to stay at Paris Saint-Germain, why? His remarks last week about, I hammer all the time and I get a bit ticked off with it in this country. And that sounded like he wanted to accelerate his move to Real Madrid this summer. I live and work in Spain. I think Mbappe is at least a generational talent, a renaissance talent, just to nick your own phrase. And therefore, I like the idea of, are we watching the last months of his PSG time? If not, are we watching him going, boy, it's fun to play with this team under Pochettino and lift the Champions League trophy and stay in France? I love all that because he's extraordinarily special. Players like him don't come along all that often. So to me, it was just an absolute Euro Millions of a game last night. It was gorgeous.
It seems as well, Graham, that there has been this international forgiveness of Neymar that seems to have occurred. Like, I think you will have always said that he is one of the best players you've seen in recent years. But there was a reluctance, I think, maybe by a lot of people who would just tune into the Champions League to allow Neymar that because of his antics sometimes. I think while those antics haven't necessarily gone away, his performances in the last two Champions League campaigns in particular have just allowed everybody to take a step back and say, holy crap, what this guy can do is absolutely unbelievable.
I agree. You need a sieve with him. You need to pan for gold because he doesn't make friends easily, but from Messi adores him. And I think there's a direct correlation between what you described on the pitch and off the pitch. Because he's never quite gone, it's important to do this right throughout his career. And I only watched a little of it in Brazil because scouts here were telling the media here, look out, Neymar's coming. And of course, one of his last big games for Santos was in the World Club final against Barcelona. And Barcelona horsed his team and he just basically stood by open mouthed and applauded Messi and kind of tried to touch him and get his autograph, even though he was going to join the Barcelona team not that long afterwards. The thing that's pockmarked his career even more than the type of injury I think it was Mario gave him in the World Cup is this flippant Peter Pan, I'll always be good, I'll always be slender, I'll always be quick, there will always be second, third and fourth chances. Going to the carnival is more important than helping out the club that pays me 300 grand a week in February. These things off the pitch, I think, are directly related. They're like stepbrothers of the people get tired of him rolling around on the pitch and faking to get free kicks. Or I remember well, he went through a phase where he wanted to promote his boots, didn't he? And he was a Barcelona and he played at Malaga one day. Malaga were still at that stage, you know, a relatively denuded club. They weren't at their strongest. But Sandro was up front for them ever. France, hello. And Neymar wanted to show off his boots. So he stood in front of a free kick that was going against Barcelona, wouldn't move and bent it unnecessarily, tied his boots. If he booked him, first time that Malaga nicked at him, he reacted, but sent off Barcelona. Do you know, these little things, including the point you made about his self-indulgence on the pitch, it had pockmarked his career a lot. One thing I would say is that certainly when I was watching him professionally rather than just as an admirer of football, now that he's out of the country I work in, he does get a lot of grief on the pitch, physical grief. He still gets quite a lot of the doings. And has that made him wake up and smell a coffee and say, you know, one of these days, one of these tackles will put me out for 8 months when I'm 31 or 32 and suddenly I'll look around and time will have flown. Carpe diem is not really one of Neymar's phrases. So he's a disappointing footballer all in all because he could have been one of the modern greats. I agree with you. I'm not certain that he has been.
Hey, Graham, we, myself and Owen were speaking this morning about how the game last night just made us forget about lockdown for a while, which was really, really enjoyable. And Keith Wood was on our show yesterday, the former Irish rugby international, and he was talking about the, you know, seeing a game behind closed doors last weekend, Munster against Toulouse, really high quality. Look, these are international footballers. Of course, they're elite. But are you surprised by the level at which these players are reaching, given that there are no fans? We talked about the lack of atmosphere and what impact that might have on football matches at the moment. But to see teams like PSG and Bayern going at it last night, does any element of it surprise you how well these teams are doing?
Shane, it's an exciting question. I'm known for speaking capital letters, and even I wouldn't claim that I always get my sentences right. And one of the times I was a little bit wrong was when there was a restart here in Spain last June, I reckon, after a proper lockdown, I was surprised. I was really surprised about how match sharp all the athletes had managed to keep themselves, how the quality of the last, that's 11-game sprint in La Liga, was soared. The quality was wonderful because, you know, the complete package of any male or female athlete at the top level is not just physical, it's mental too. And therefore, I think, in my opinion, you know, I watch a lot of Keith's sports still to this day. I still watch a lot of cricket and a lot of golf above and beyond the football. And therefore, I broadly have been a little bit surprised. And the way I would complement it would be that yesterday I was fortunate enough to spend a long time, 45 minutes interviewing Kevin De Bruyne. And just he tossed away a casual phrase in the middle of an answer where he went, physically we're fine. And he didn't just mean Manchester City. He was talking about the current great players in this situation. He said, physically we're fine. We're elite athletes. He said, the tough thing is mental freshness in this situation. And the tough thing is winning and winning again in the current, the type of vacuum of the normal stimuli that Keith was talking about to you in order to help you be elite in performance over and over and over again. So that mental side, it's funny how malleable we are as the human spirit, human psychology, because mostly the sports I watch at the level you're asking about, mostly they've excelled and planners and coaches and players and reserves have become accustomed far more quickly than I know we're a year into it nearly. But I've become, and I've begun to speak more regularly to footballers in the interviews that I do about what they feel about the absence of crowds. And it's that little stimulus that will lift you when you're not fresh, when maybe you're losing, or the stimulus to when you're on top of a team, as Bayern were last night, to put your foot absolutely to the floor and thrash them. So we see an influence still to this day, even though broadly most sports have become used to not having fans. We do see marginal changes in what we're watching and how the results are. But just to go back to your, I think De Bruyne answered your question. I think that the point Keith was making, I think if you're physically fine and you're technically excellent, you can see. I mean, was it the Leinster defeat of Munster you were talking about? I think it was.
Munster beating, or Munster losing to Toulouse.
To Toulouse after that. So that was after that game, pardon me. Then I think reaching a level of excellence is feasible. And De Bruyne's point is a complimentary one about what does surprise me is how they've kept themselves mentally engaged, mentally fresh. When they like, because what we often forget about, I don't know if Keith touched on this, it's all these people that we admire and watch, although you and Owen and I, we get to meet them and talk to them. A lot of people in our industry, and certainly some of the public, forget that they're human beings with their own fears. So, for example, not long ago, I sat and interviewed Rafa Varane prior to the Atalanta tie. Fascinating, articulate, charming, made a real bond with him, was wishing him well in terms of his personal performance against Liverpool. Morning of the game, bang, it's gone COVID. There's a fear for him. He's got young kids. They have all these men and women who entertain us in sports since the pandemic arrived. They've had their own fears and losses because of it, and yet they still go out and perform. That's the mental psychological side chain that long after this is gone and vaccines have reduced the threat, that I'll be admiring them and I'll be thankful for what they've given us.
Can I just pick up briefly there, Graham, and something, the Kevin De Bruyne point? I mean, that's fascinating that you had that time to sit down with him. And obviously, we had the news yesterday of his new contract with Manchester City. And the really interesting points as well that he kind of did his own research and had his own stats people do research into what he will bring to the club and what the club will bring to him in terms of his trophy ambitions over the coming years. And another extraordinary performance from him the other night. What sort of tidbits did you garner from him in speaking with him? I mean, just another quote-unquote, I guess, Peter Pan player.
Yeah, I use that phrase. I come to De Bruyne. So I use that phrase in a derogatory way. I wouldn't say I would use it to them, because my Peter Pan allusion is to guys who think they'll always be as they are. They won't be, and they waste time. That's my dig there in general. And De Bruyne, I admire him as much as you do. I think he's a deeply intelligent footballer, and I spoke to after the interview, I spoke to one of his coaches who's like really hard, really bright, really football intelligent man who doesn't suffer fools gladly. Tidbits I can't give because this interview, there were two parts to the interview and they don't come out in one case for a couple of weeks, another case for a couple of months. What I would tell you was that his mood, we never once talked about renewal, but his mood was buoyant, he was patient, he was he was very, very good at explaining his art. He was extremely good at explaining the technique of how he does what he does. Again, one of the reasons that I've loved being involved with Off the Ball for however many years is now, since 2003, is the breadth of coverage you give to all world sports, which in my opinion is a higher quality than the BBC in the UK. And therefore you speak to a lot of different people. And I suspect that you choose so wisely about who answers your questions that probably you don't speak to those in their sports who can do but can't explain. What I treasure is finding footballers, because that's broadly where I operate, who can not only show us that they're elite, show the leadership, show the technique, show the toughness, but they can explain what it is that they do that makes them different, and explain the technical side of the sport that we all appreciate and we describe in our reports and our conversations like this. But we need to be fed from them because they keep advancing all the time. And that's what De Bruyne did. I mean, he talked a little bit about the influence of Pep. He talked a little bit about one of the themes that came out most strongly. And I think it clashed a little bit. I will not exaggerate it with public perception of Manchester City, because I think it's perceived as being a millionaire's playground. It's funded by a foreign state to Manchester, and people question, is it brilliance of planning or is it pure money injection? The theme that came out over and over again with De Bruyne was that the one of the reasons that he's staying is the winning mentality that he sees around him day to day in the playing staff, in the coaching staff, in the owners, that there's a relentless hunger to win, and he expects that to abide. And that was one of the most, one of the strongest themes, because he, again, like many elite people I speak to, he said, I abhor losing. I detest losing. I cannot stand it. I have to win. I'm not here to be comfortable. He said, if I wasn't enjoying and if I wasn't winning, he said, never mind the money, I would stop now. So for those who look at the length of the contract he signed Shane at 29, I thought those are themes and words that promise good things in the remainder of his City career, which wasn't it till 2025, I think, which is 21. So it's a deal that maybe takes him to something like 33. It's a hell of a deal to be signing at that age. Really impressive.
Yeah, it certainly is. There was definitely a part of my brain last night, or two nights ago, watching De Bruyne and Haaland on opposite sides and thinking to myself, God, this would just be magical to see them both in the same park.
There was a little thing at the end, wasn't there, between Foden and Haaland, look, they like each other, they're talking, therefore, done deal.
Well, you were on with us, I'd say, a month ago, Graham, and you were one of the first people to confidently say on the show that Spain are going to play a big part in the future of where Erling Haaland goes. We've now seen over the past couple of weeks that the Haaland tour has taken itself to the Bernabeu and to the Camp Nou, and Mino Raiola and Haaland Senior are both willing to flog Erling to one of the Spanish clubs if they outbid Manchester City. What's your sense on who the most likely of those two are to get the job done, and if they will actually beat Manchester City to the chase?
It's a really confusing picture. I thank you for asking it that way, because I haven't got any breaking news. My sense of it is that Joan Laporta, understandably, is completely obsessed by buying Haaland. And I wrote a column for ESPN talking about how understandable that is, because people will immediately point to the ridiculous debt, 1.1 billion globally, that Barcelona have imposed upon themselves by their stupidity. There's something like 700 million that's scheduled to be repaid this summer, although some of that will be rescheduled. So the debt picture is horrendous, but Laporta will attract new money, new credit. And therefore, he's placed in a position of going, is this, although he bears no physical resemblance, is this the next Messi or Cristiano that we're looking at? Is Haaland that? And if so, do you grab him at any cost? I just say, God, we've got him. We make him part of our own. We make him happy for 7 years. We make sure he's not doing us damage. All these things are going through. Now, different things are going through Florentino Perez's mind, given that they spent an enormous amount on the stadium. The stadium will become a talking point. It's going to be an event stadium, not a football stadium. An event stadium where they keep the pitch under the Paseo Castellano, the big long road that bisects Madrid. It's going to be like a little Bela Lugosi thing. The pitch is going to be kept in perfect condition, buried under the road, and then hauled up mechanically to be placed for football games. I don't know, to 35 times a year, and the rest of the year, once the Bernabeu is finished, it's going to be an event space, a conference space. It's going to be generating huge money for Madrid, and that will change their place in the firmament, maybe make it even higher up in the firmament. But that's costing at the moment, and their objective was Mbappe, without question. He came and trained there. He idolizes Zidane. He told them a couple of years ago when leaving Monaco, I'll sign for you if you get rid of one of Bale, Cristiano, or Benzema. They didn't. He didn't sign for them. They regret it, obviously. So they're looking at Haaland and going, we kind of want you if we don't get Mbappe, but not quite that bluntly, which is not a great message to be giving out to anybody. So at the moment, I don't know where he's going. The Eintracht Frankfurt result at last weekend obviously made it far less likely Dortmund play in the Champions League, and therefore far more likely that Haaland says, I'm going. Dortmund don't have to sell him. Zorki keeps saying, we're not going to sell him. That's probably German man speak with forked tongue. So, I wish I knew where he was going. It did kind of look as if he was quite excited to be talking to guys in Sky Blue Strips the other day. I can't avoid saying that. Mm. So I wish I had a story for you about where, but if the 20 million, the reports in the media here that Arfinger Haaland and Raiola need to get 20 million quid for consultancy on the deal each, they look leaked. If that's true, that's the straw that breaks the camel's back for me. I can't imagine Barcelona in their current state saying, there's all that money to Dortmund, there's all that money we're going to pay Haaland, the player, and there's 40 mil between the two people representing him. That bit would need to change, otherwise I don't see him playing in Spain next summer. But Barcelona want him to be. They want him to be their big signing. There's no question about that.
Yeah, that's really interesting because, as you say, maybe Real Madrid are putting him off the scent with their interest in Mbappe. Barcelona might be thrown off the scent because they're in debt and maybe can't afford to pay his dad a hell of a lot of money as well as the player himself, which kind of leaves Manchester.
He's coming to the Bulls. If you want, the Bulls have got him. There you are. It's as simple as that. If that's what you were fishing for, the Bulls fans, get ready. It's all next season.
The other big talking point from the week we wanted to put to you, Graham, was this Real Madrid performance a couple of nights ago. It seems like a really stupid thing to say in hindsight, but if you've got a midfield of Casemiro, Kroos and Modric, it's probably a bad idea to write them off in the first instance.
But that's the wrong phrase. It's probably the wrong idea to give them time and space.
Yeah.
The whole after you, Claude, nature of Liverpool's performance just baffled me. I know that their batteries are run down mentally as much as physically. But we've had Jota back. If you look at the first goal, because, I swear that the amount of technology that's available in the football industry now allows you to predict what your opponent will have for breakfast a week on Tuesday and where he's going his holidays in 2025. So your software will also tell you Toni Kroos doesn't like being harassed and pressed because he's a little bit slower than he was. Toni Kroos does like being given lots of room to quarterback things. And look at the first goal. He's dropped deep. He's on the right side of Madrid's build. And, at that stage, it's got to be, I think, Wijnaldum and Jota. When I looked at the pitch positions, neither of them, or Mane, who can come across, none of them have closed him, look like pressing him, or shouting to each other, we've got to get. Given that amount of time, he could put a 75-yard pass on a thin down blindfolded. So the fact that he picked out the flipping crest on Vinicius' shirt was not a surprise. For some, the surprise was the brilliance of Vinicius' control because, all I heard in post-analysis was, look at the two centre-halves and two far. I mean, I almost used a phrase that I've not used live on radio. I mean, for goodness sake, there were minuscule mistakes in the placement of Liverpool centre defenders because they had the right to expect that their teammates would try to asphyxiate Cruz and that the ball wouldn't be allowed to be delivered so perfectly. So there you go. Second one, that's why in my book, Keita was whipped off immediately because Klopp had roared at them about, don't let that happen. For the second goal, Cruz is on the other side of the pitch. Therefore, it's another sector of players who haven't done their work properly, including Keita. And his ball is a little bit less good this time, but it's good enough to catch Trent off. So to answer your question, I don't think anybody was writing them off because Real Madrid or Real Madrid, there was, I spoke to four or five different people, some who are in their camp, some worked with players there, one guy who reports to them, and they all said, Madrid is mucho Madrid. It's a way of saying what you said, never write them off. This is pre-match, even though Varane had been coveted out of the contest. And Liverpool didn't have to excel. They didn't have to be at the level they were when they pumped Barcelona at 4-0. They simply had to go, give them no space, give them no time to think, give them no time to breathe. And they had that capacity. Jota is not one of these who's been overused. Okay, he's back from injury. But they could have asked the front three to press voraciously and not allow Cruz to court back. And Fabinho was the hidden hero of knocking Barcelona out. Because across the tie, he was Casemiro, but in a red shirt. Mm. Streetwise, a little bit thuggish, got away with things with the referee, broke up flow. And then on the third goal, schoolboys who play football, like, when is a throw-in near your own box? You don't go chasing the ball if it's lobbed in there. You stay with your man, because it's the box. If you give your man, you know, half a metre, never mind 4 metres, which he did, you're screwed. And Fabinho's decision to go chasing the ball into the line and then, oh, Modric has got it now and his body weight was all wrong, and Modric's like, thank you very much, pal. And what happens is Phillips gets a beating for the fact that the ball goes through his legs, and Vinicius says, that's not the point. The point is, don't let a Ballon d'Or winner have oodles of space. Space. James Tiberius Kirk told us, space. Final frontier, Toppy would have said, space has to be denied against Real Madrid, and they didn't own, and it was bizarre.
Very quickly, Graham, a prediction for El Clasico this weekend?
Yeah, thank you for that. Barcelona are much smarter now than they were. I think they're capable of winning, and I think that Real Madrid's eggs are all in the Liverpool basket. So it might even be Messi's last Clasico. Don't forget that. We all think he's going to stay now, but the ink isn't dry on the contract. It might be, big capital letters, this might be Leo Messi's last Clasico. Barca.
Yeah. Now, what a shame, as Shane said earlier on, to have that without fans there. But God, it's an unbelievable prospect, and what a title race. Graham Hunter, we'll chat to you again soon, no doubt. Thanks a million.
Adios.
The OTB Podcast Network with Green Farm on the go. Snack smart with 100% natural protein-powered chicken bites.